Assalamu alaikum och hjärtligt välkommen till Koranpodden. Jag heter Sally och du lyssnar på säsongsfinalen, poddavsnitt 108 som blir fjärde och sista avsnittet i min poddradioserie om äventyraren, antirasisten och den danske muslimen Knud Holmbos liv i fyra poddavsnitt. Detta poddavsnitt blir årets sista avsnitt som sätter punkt för säsong 2. Mer om säsong 3 kommer i slutet på detta avsnitt. Du ska alldeles strax få lyssna på mitt samtal tillsammans med syster Safia Aoude från Köpenhamn som är expert på Knud Holmbos liv. Jag fick äran att träffa henne och sitta ner tillsammans och intervjua henne om Knud Holmbos liv i Köpenhamns universitet. Men innan du ska få lyssna på min intervju med Safia så vill jag personligen tacka Sofia som lämnade en fantastisk recension via Apple Podcast och iTunes som värmde mitt hjärta något oerhört. Hon skriver: som icke-muslim men sökande och intresserad av islam är denna podd oerhört värdefull för mig. Jag är uppvuxen i en svensk kristen familj men har länge kallat mig ateist. Nu vandrar jag på vägen mot islam, två steg fram och ett steg bak. Tack för att du och dina gäster kommer hem till mig med intressanta samtal. Uppskattar att du har med flera kvinnor också. Fortsätt så. Det underlättar för mig som kvinnlig lyssnare att relatera. Ser också gärna fler samtal med konvertiter. Som svensk är det guld värd att få höra deras historier och kunna identifiera sig med dem. Stort tack för att du gör måndagarna till en dag som man ser fram emot. Jag önskar dig all lycka till med ditt fortsatta arbete. Slutcitat. Tack Sofia för dina fina ord och jag hoppas du finner det du söker. Att du finner hem till Gud. Må Allah visa dig och oss alla vägen och underlätta för dig och ge dig det bästa. Amin. Detta blir som sagt sista poddavsnittet för säsong 2. Men så länge Gud ger mig kraft och ork så kommer jag med hans hjälp fortsätta producera nya poddavsnitt varje vecka för att inspirera dig Sofia och alla andra som lyssnar varje måndag. Jag är jättenyfiken på att få veta vad just du tycker om Koranpodden. Lämnar du också en recension precis som Sofia och många andra med din iPhone? Länken för att lämna en recension finns på koranpodden.se/108 och under avsnittsinformationen i din poddspelare. Det tar inte mer än 2-3 minuter att lämna en recension, men det betyder jättemycket för mig. Så stort tack på förhand. Jag besökte som sagt Knud Holmbo-kännaren och experten Safia Aoude i Köpenhamn tillsammans med Hussein Hammed. Vi träffade henne i meditationsrummet i Köpenhamns universitet. Det var fantastiskt att få dela tid med en syster som är så kunnig om bror Knud Holmbo. Jag frågar Safia om hur hon för första gången kom i kontakt med Knud Holmbos bok Öknen brinner. Safia berättar också om hur hon kom att skriva en så viktig bok om Knud Holmbos liv på danska. Jag frågar Safia om Knud Holmbos muslimska tro och identitet. Safia återberättar unik fakta om Knud Holmbos liv som aldrig förekommer i Öknen brinner. Denna nya information som Safia delar med sig av är väldigt fascinerande och samtidigt väldigt viktig. Ett superstort tack till Safia som dedikerade 5 år av sin tid för att forska, resa och gräva fram ovärderlig ny information om Knud Holmbos liv och för att hon tog sig tiden och träffade mig i Köpenhamns universitet. Okej, nog med försnack. Här är min intervju med Knud Holmbo-kännaren och experten Safia Aoude som på samma sätt som mig blev alldeles tagen och hänförd efter att ha läst Öknen brinner av Knud Holmbo. Start this. It's recording now. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. So I'm here together with Safia Aoude. I hope I pronounced your last name correct.
You did. If you wanted to start by, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, right now I'm a student here at the Copenhagen University. I'm studying a minor in history and religion, but I'm also a writer, I'm a lawyer, I'm a Muslim activist, so that's who I am.
That's a lot of different roles in one person.
Well, yeah, but there are a lot of different days in one week, so you can choose.
Today is Thursday, so what kind of role do you have on Thursdays?
On Thursdays, I'm mostly retired.
Okay. So in this fantastic building, do you want to tell us a little bit about the building?
Yeah, that's a very new building because Copenhagen University is totally renovating itself right now. That's why you see all the contracting and building outside. So they made this big building, and we are sitting right now in the prayer room. It's not called a prayer room, it's called a meditation room, but nobody uses it except for praying, and we all know that's the Muslim students, they come here to pray. Sometimes the Christians come to pray, but we are very happy to have this room.
Yeah, we also have that at the Malmo University. Let's see here. I read a fantastic book about Knud Holmboe, a Danish convert who wrote a book translated into Swedish, Öknen Brinner. And I was so fascinated. And when I met Muslims in Denmark and I asked them, do you know about Knud Holmboe? One of the Muslim brothers, he told me your name, that you have written a book about Knud Holmboe. So do you want to just explain shortly who is Knud Holmboe to those who do not know who he is?
Well, he's very fascinating because he was one of the first Danish Muslims. He was not the first because there have always been Danish Muslims in Denmark. But he was a convert, born in 1901. And he was, you know, he was a bit of a dreamer. He was a bit of a high-energy person. And high-energy persons, they have a bit of trouble to conform into society. So he went to North Africa, he went to the Middle East, he traveled, and he found Islam and converted to Islam when he was very, very young, in the beginning in his 20s. And then he went to Libya. And he traveled with an old Chevrolet Model 29, and he traveled all over Libya even before there were any roads. He was traveling through the desert, through the mountains. And then he met the Libyan resistance in Libya, who were fighting against the Italian occupation. And he wrote this book, and it was very fascinating because he was the only one that actually took up, he was a journalist, you know. So he didn't just write a book, he wrote articles about this. And he enraged the Italian government because at that time in the 20s, everybody loved fascism. You know, it was a nice thing, it brought order and everything. And he was, you know, criticizing the colonist fascists in Libya, and he made it public. And he did it also in Albania. He took pictures of people that were lynched by the fascist colonists in Albania. So he made awareness about all these atrocities. And then he was killed on his way to Mecca as a pilgrim. So he became a shaheed, he became a martyr.
Because the book Öknen Brinner is this fascinating story where he takes this old car and drives through the desert and he get holes in the tires and then they have to stop and try to fix it and they have limited water. And then he meets this 12-year-old Muhammad whose father was killed by the Italians. A very touching story, and also the affection that he has for this 12-year-old boy. And it's a fascinating story, and I wish that more Muslims would read this book. How did you discover Knud Holmboe?
Well, as a child in Libya, when we went to the National Museum, there was the picture of Omar Mukhtar, the freedom resistance leader, the freedom fighter, and then there was this glass cubicle, and there were his glasses and everything, and then there was this picture of this funny-looking man, you know. Obviously, he was Western, he wasn't Libyan, but he was wearing Libyan clothes, and I asked, who was that? Oh, that was somebody from Denmark. And I said, great, Denmark, because I live in Denmark. So I said, wow, he's Danish, what did he do? When was this? And they said, oh, this was in the 20s, he joined the Omar Mukhtar resistance. And I said, this is impossible, you can't do that when you come from Denmark. But when I went back to Denmark, as I became a teenager, I found the book at the library. No, it wasn't at the library. It was actually at a yard sale, a used book yard sale. And I found this book and I read it and I thought, wow, this guy, this Danish guy who actually gave his life for Libya, why don't we hear more about him? And at a time when I was just finishing my law degree and my family took on a long vacation, they left me during the summer to write my thesis. But I didn't really write my thesis because I thought, well, I'm going to write a biography of this man. I'm going to research everything. So I spent around 5 years researching his life, traveling where he traveled, not just in Libya, but in Morocco, in Palestine, talking to the people who actually remember him, who were still alive at that time. And then I wrote this biography.
Wow. So you met the people that actually met Knud Hornbo?
Yes, I met some of them. I contacted everybody, including we found the guy, the young boy you talked about, and we found the son of Roscoe Tarbox, who was also traveling with him in the car to Libya. We found in a Bedouin camp in Jordan, we found a former slave. Slavery was illegal, but they call him, he was a slave. He was an African slave. And he remembered as a child, this man, he remembered him. And I thought, wow, is this really possible?
Yeah, because, I mean, there weren't so many white people in North Africa, so it has to stood out in the crowd, so people remember him. But so you actually met the 12-year-old Mohammed. That's fascinating.
I didn't meet the 12-year-old Mohammed. I met the I think 80-year-old Mohammed, and he passed away a few years ago. He lived to almost 95 years old, I think he was.
So what did he tell about Knud Hornbo?
Not much, because he was very shy. He just remembered it. It was something from his childhood, and he remembered this man, and he couldn't really tell anything more than we already know from the books and the pictures.
Yeah. So what else did you learn while you traveled in his the way that he traveled? That's not part of the book.
Yeah, well, I learned that you can't travel through the Libyan desert even with an SUV. It's very, very difficult. So I wonder how on earth did this guy use a veteran car to travel through the desert? But also the book stops at his... when he came to Benghazi, the book stops. You know, he was jailed and expelled, and that's where the book stops. But I wanted to know more. I wanted to know what happened after this and until he got killed on his way to Mecca. So I tried, I really went into the archives of all the countries in Libya, in Italy, in Germany, in Denmark, in America. I tried to find newspaper clippings, letters, pictures, everything. And, of course, I came in touch with his daughter, who was a very small toddler at that time. But she had, of course, she missed her father, so she had collected everything. So I had these big boxes at her home and was allowed to archive everything according to where it belongs, to the years and everything. So and I read all the things he did from his childhood, where he wrote small theater pieces, and until his letters to his parents and his experiences, the pictures that were never published, articles that were never published, newspaper archives, everything. So I really learned this man. I learned to know him, even though I never met him.
What's so fascinating about him when you have dedicated so much of your time and energy? You know, I just read the book and I was so fascinated. There was also these questions. What happened when he came back? What happened with this person that met him? But you have gone through it all. What's so fascinating about him?
It's of course it's a mystery. Where did he go? Because we know he was killed, but I want to know what actually happened to this man. I tried even to find out maybe he's buried somewhere in Saudi Arabia. We went illegally into Saudi Arabia at the Jordanian border. We tried to contact contractors. Have they ever found some human remains while building in the area? Everything. That's the mystery of his death. We want to know what happened. We want to maybe find his remains and maybe make some kind of closure. We never did accomplish this. But also he's fascinating because he was a young man. At the time I wrote the biography, I was his age, a little younger. And I could identify with this man because he was a seeker, he was a high-energy person, and he was somebody who didn't really conform into society. Mm-hmm. And I think every young man or even woman could recognize herself or himself in the person of Knud Hornbo. Mm-hmm. But also the fascinating search for a spirituality, the way he embraced Islam in a very kind way, in a very easy, transcendent way. I really like that, and that's fascinating.
Yeah. What more can you tell us about his Muslim faith and belief?
Well, when you find some of his writings as a kid, actually, as a teenager, he was flirting with Islam. He had all these Islamic ideas, he was writing something, and then he it was a quote he took from some place like Goethe's Diwan, and he was fascinated by Islam already as a teenager. But then he went to live in a convent. He tried to convert to Catholicism, and he tried to live in a convent, and he couldn't really relate to the materialism in the Catholic religion. So he went to North Africa. He went to the Middle East, and where he came into contact with a lot of Muslims. And then somewhere around 26, 27, he converted to Islam formally. And that was in Morocco, I think.
He was very critical of colonialism, about fascism and Mussolini. And in his book, he explained this very well, and about the people who get hanged every weekend. It's like a routine. And also he describes the Italians in Libya, how they look down upon the Arabs and all these things. And he explains this, and he tells the story back to Denmark, because that was not the age of information like we have it today. A lot of people in Denmark didn't know how Italians were treating the natives. And he tells the story. What's your view upon Knut Hornborg and his critique of colonialism and fascism?
Well, it's very interesting, because even though the time was not for criticism, these were the roaring 20s before the recession, and everybody was happy with materialism and happy with colonialism and happy with fascism in Europe. At that time, I read some sources from the British Parliament. They were talking about Mussolini and Hitler, and they were saying Mr. Hitler, Mr. Mussolini, and they were Anthony Eden, they were praising them, and you thought, how could they do that? But of course they didn't know how fascism was going to evolve later on. But the family of Knut Hornborg, his brother actually died in the fight against Nazism, against the German occupation in Denmark later on. So the family were very idealistic. They were about justice, about rightfulness, and he inherited some of that spirit. So I don't really, the family, they were maybe angry with him because he wasn't really conform. He didn't like to go to school. He didn't settle down when he was married and had a normal life, normative life. But they continued to back up on his idea of idealism and fighting fascism.
So he was before his time of critiquing fascism. As you say, it was very popular in Europe, but he showed fascism's evil side, if you could say.
Yes, exactly. He was very early on with the criticism. Before that, you had criticism from maybe communists, but not really from normal people, not like journalists. Everybody in journalism was fascinated by the way things went in Germany and Italy. But he could see through something. He could see the evil, and he was talking about that. And he was showing how evil fascism was carried out in Albania, in Libya, in Transjordania, in Turkey even. He was writing about the fascism of Kemal Atatürk at a time when everybody praised their hands that Kemal Atatürk was, you know, European, westernizing the Turkish society. He saw through this.
Very fascinating, very interesting. You read his book also. When you think about his book, what are the highlights for you?
Well, there are so many highlights, but the biggest highlight is, of course, when he was captured by the resistance in Libya. And, you know, as a history student, I know that the sources are always more reliable the closer they get to the actually happening. So when I went through the box at his family and looked at the letters he sent, at some of the articles he was writing that never got published, he said he met Omar Mukhtar. And later in the book, of course...
Sorry, because he never says that in the book, right?
No, he doesn't say that in the book. But he says this. He says he met Omar Mukhtar and talked to him in the letters and in the articles that weren't published. So later on, he wrote the book. A year later, when he came back to Denmark, then he wrote the book. And there was not a word about Omar Mukhtar. But then
why?
Well, because he had a mission. The Libyan rebels, freedom fighters, they were asking him, please help us because we are being butchered. This is genocide. We need help from the outside. And what he did after he was expelled from Benghazi, he didn't go straight back to Denmark. He went to Egypt and tried to arrange a caravan to help the Libyan people in Al-Kufra, who were in imminent danger of an Italian attack. So maybe he was just being quiet, And we know that he had letters with him on his way to the pilgrimage to contact Ahmed as-Sanusi, who was in Mecca, who was one of the Libyan resistance leaders in exile. So maybe he was just not talking about this out of security. Who knows?
Does he say anything specific about Omar bin Mukhtar in the letters?
He just said he when he was taken, he went to their camp. He was taken to their camp, and he met the leader. And the leader talked to him. Omar Mukhtar talked to him about different things and talked to him. Please help us, help us. And later on, when he was in Benghazi, he went straight to Cairo to talk to another Libyan leader who later became King Idris. And King Idris said, "Well, maybe the French should govern Libya instead of." That was the best he could make. So.
It's a fascinating person that he's not just a journalist, he's not just writing about it, he's actively involved in the resistance. And when you read his story, you can understand that he cannot just write about it, he has to do something. I mean, that's his consciousness telling that this is not right. And I mean, the things that he explains is like, that was a genocide. They were really like killing the people. And when you read it, the men, they just, there's some, when he explains about, they take the, like 2-3 people and they take them to the court, and the judge says execution by hanging, and the men are like, well, what about my family? I have like 4 or 5 daughters. Who's going to take care of them? It's so like brutal, that fascist Italian government.
It was very brutal, and Knuhenbuch's book wasn't allowed to be published in Italy until the 80s. The movie that was basically based on much of his book, the very famous movie, Lion of the Desert with Anthony Quinn. Some of the things that were in this film were actually based on Knuhenbuch's book. And this film was also not allowed in Italy until I think 2001 or something like this. So it's still a... something you don't want to talk about it in Italy. When I went to the Italian archives in Rome to find out something about them, did they put a hit contract on him, the Italians? The archives, they weren't very, really open, and they weren't giving access to the archives still, even though, you know, it's a long time ago.
Yeah, exactly. So why did Knuhenbuch convert to Islam, according to your research?
I think he was seeking something. He was seeking something that made him relax a bit, because he was a very troubled soul. When I say he was a high energy person, I also meant that he was, you know, like a big bit sanguinic. He was fluttering from idea to idea, place to place, education to education. He didn't really have a fixing point in his life. And when he converted to Islam, you can see in his writing and his lifestyle that he's actually, you know, he's relaxing. He found himself somehow. And I think what appealed much to him, I have some of his poems. When he was 22, he published the poems. And the poems, they're all about death, all about existentialism, the meaning of life, nature, and God. So he had it in him. He wanted to get in touch with God somehow, but he didn't really get the system. He didn't really get the God's number, if I can say like this. He needed to get in touch with God. He needed to find God's number, and I think he found it in Islam. When I talked over with his daughter Aisha, and sadly she passed away too.
One second. His daughter Aisha.
Yes. Yes.
You want to explain a little bit about that?
Well, his daughter Aisha was 4 or 5 years old when he disappeared and was killed. So she never knew her father, as I told you. But she knew him only through his writings, his books, his pictures and everything. And the first person I went to when I started my research into his life, his biography, was of course his daughter. And I found she didn't live far away from where I lived. So I just called her and said, listen, I want to talk to you. Oh, another one, she said. So there were coming people from all over the world to talk to her.
Wow. Yeah. And she's a Muslim also?
No, she's not a Muslim. Well, she's an an agnostic. And she told me maybe he wouldn't have stopped at the Islam point. Maybe he would have found something else. And I had a discussion with her. I said, I don't think he would have gone further than Islam. I think he would have stopped in Islam.
Yeah, I Can you just cut? But I think I cut you off there. You were going to say something about her daughter that I was thinking.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, that her daughter didn't think he was going to stop at Islam. She was thinking maybe he's going to be a Buddhist when he go to India or something like that. But I don't think so. I thought he felt very much at home in Islam, so I thought he would have stayed.
His legacy for Danish Muslims today, and even Swedish Muslims, so let's say Scandinavian Muslims, what is his legacy for us today? What can we learn from his life?
Well, I think there are a lot of legacies that he has that he can pass on to the Danish or Swedish Muslims or any Muslims at all. And that's, you know, that's the love for religion without being, you know, a radical extremist. He was, you know, how to feel at home in Islam, even though maybe you're not an Arab or anything. You can feel at home in Islam even though you're a convert. Also, his sense for justice. I know this is a very dangerous topic because a lot of people have sense for justice and they went to ISIS to join the Daesh, and that's a danger. And that's not what Knut was doing when he joined the resistance. He was doing something else. And you can fight injustice not by carrying a gun. You can fight injustice by writing, by talking about it, by you know, being an activist, an intellectual activist. That's a possibility too.
Very fascinating. Any final thoughts about Knud Hornbø that you would want to tell the audience?
Yeah, it's like, you know, he's a part of Danish history, but they don't really talk about him. And I wonder why he's not so popular in Danish history. Maybe because he died so young, he was only 29. Or maybe because that was, you know, fascism, Italian colonialism. That's an old story. I don't know why. Even in the debate, you know, Muslims in Denmark, Danish Muslims, it's a big debate in Denmark right now, but they don't really mention Knud Hornbø. They mention Islam as something that's new and coming to disturb the Danish coherence and everything. But we had Islam in Denmark. 1,000 years ago, we had Islam in Denmark. And even 100 years ago, Knud Hornbø, he was a Muslim and that was no big deal. So we should talk more about him. We should read more about him. We should know about him.
I mean, you know a lot of Danish Muslims, and get in touch with the Danish community, Danish Muslim community. Do the Muslims know who Knud Hornbø is, or is there a lot of you know, ignorance about him?
There's still a lot of ignorance, especially with the young generations. Some of the older generations, some of the first so-called Muslims in the 60s, 70s, like Abdul Wahid Peterson, you must have talked to him. They know who he was. But the younger generation don't really know him. That's why I think there should be more awareness for the younger generation. We some years ago was in contact with Dr. Fadl Suleiman from Egypt, very famous Muslim activist and intellectual, and he actually worked on a website to promote the book, because it was 70 years ago and there wasn't any copyright on the book anymore. So he made copies of the book to read online and promote it in English and in Arabic language. And I gave him some of the pictures he could use for that website. But I think, I don't know if it's active anymore. Mm-hmm. But we should do this. We should have some awareness about Knud Hornbø and about how to be a Muslim in times of trouble, in times of calm.
If I can just spontaneously think, I would like to see exhibitions with Knud Hornbø, you know, where you can, you know, read parts of his story. And I think it's very, very important Danish cultural heritage, Knud Hornbø, and to lift him up. And my goal with the Kuranpodden is to have a series of episodes about Knud Hornbø with quotations from his book, because the book is like very fascinating, and you know, I cannot encourage enough for people to read that book.
I think we need a Danish Muslim museum, because as I told you, Islam has a very old story in Denmark. There were Muslims in Denmark 1,000 years ago, and there were interaction between Muslims and the Vikings for more than 1,000 years ago. So we need this a kind of museum about Danish Muslim heritage, and you could have an entire room with him there, his pictures and everything. There are still the boxes are ready, everything is ready, even his some of his hats and everything is still there. So you could make an exhibition, and that way people could learn about the Muslim heritage in Denmark and learn about this great man.
So how do you relate to Knud Hornbø today? You know, do your thoughts go to him sometimes? You think about him, or like?
Every time I was in Jordan 2 months ago, and every time I'm in Jordan, I go to the south, to Aqaba, I go to the Saudi border, and then I just stand there and stare, and I say, why can't I go inside and try to find where he is? Why are the Saudis so stubborn? They don't give me a visa so I can just go. What's the problem? That's my biggest frustration, because I know what he did in his life, and I know people love him, and I love him, and we know about the heritage I just talked to you about. But I want to know I want to find him. I want to know what really happened.
And as Muslims with the belief in the afterlife, I hope, inshallah, that you one day can sit together with Hornbill in the next life and talk to him, and he can explain everything that happened, inshallah.
Isn't Allah, that would be nice, but I think as a martyr, he has a place in heaven much longer before me.
Inshallah. So I would like to thank you for this opportunity to meet you, and I hope, inshallah, that I want to invite you to Malmo, that we can have a seminar where you can show the pictures and tell the story, because there's a lot of brothers and sisters, especially in Malmo, that don't know about his story, and I think he has a very important story with the social justice, not just to write about things, but to actively get involved, but also be balanced. Like, he's just, but he's not being unjust, or he's not going to extremism. He's just, but he's on the right path. And I like that about him. I would like to have a seminar about him, inshallah. I hope you can come and share some wisdom about that.
Well, I love to do that. I do some presentations on him, but mostly it's in churches, actually. The people in the church, mostly elderly people, they want to know about this old Danish Muslim, you know. So, but I love to come to Malmö anytime.
Yeah. Shukran. Thank you so much for your time. And I think we have some question from Hussein. If you can come to the mic.
If I may interrupt. Sorry. My question is, I have been reading The Road to Mecca by Muhammad Asad. And I didn't read this book, but I put it on my Goodreads list to read it, inshallah. So my question is, the stories, they sound similar. In my ears, there is a lot of similarity between the journeys that they took, the both of them. And the other thing is, it seems like the both of like Knut Hornbu and Muhammad Asad, Leopold Weiss, both of them had a connection or contact with Umar al-Mukhtar. Do you think that Knut Hornbu and Muhammad Asad may have met, or do you have some like evidence of that you have been in encounter?
Well, I wish you asked me before this interview, because I could go to the archives I made, and then I have these keywords but I can search for. So I don't know. Possibly he could have met. I don't know. I have to go down and look at if it's possible to find some information.
Have you read Muhammad Asad Road to Mecca?
I probably have. I don't really remember it. But as I told you, if you told me before this interview, I would have freshened up if I had read it before.
It feels like we have to come for a second visit.
You are welcome. Most welcome.
Thank you so much. Any other questions, Hussein?
No, thank you.
Thank you for that question. It was a great one. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Barakallahu fik.
Wa alaikum assalam alaikum.
Tack för att du har lyssnat på min poddradioserie om Knut Hornbu och hans väg till islam. Det har varit otroligt inspirerande för mig att få förbereda, skriva manus och spela in denna unika poddradioserie. Jag hoppas att du har tyckt att serien har varit lika inspirerande som jag har tyckt. Om du har blivit inspirerad och funnit denna serie givande, skulle jag vara supertacksam om du ville berätta för dina vänner om denna unika poddradioserie via sociala medier. Låt oss tillsammans lyfta och uppmärksamma denna fantastiska människa som bror Knut Hornbu var. Detta avsnitt 108, blir årets sista poddavsnitt. Det har varit ett fantastiskt år för mig att få arbeta med Koranpodden. Jag är djupt tacksam till Allah för detta. Det har aldrig varit en börda, tvärtom har det varit otroligt glädjefyllt och lärorikt. All den kärlek och stöd som ni lyssnare har visat har varit mycket uppmuntrande för mig. Men nu tar jag ett längre vinteruppehåll och vilar ut ordentligt och spenderar quality time med min familj, släkt och vänner. Jag är tillbaka igen, inshallah, den 3 februari 2020. Skriv in det i din kalender med en helt ny säsong 3. Det blir nya och spännande intervjuer, poddradioserier som kommer att stärka din tro och berika ditt liv, inshallah. Som du vet så har vi aktivt valt att tacka nej till statliga och kommunala och utländska bidrag. Koranpodden drivs med andra ord uteslutande av Sveriges muslimer och så vill vi att det ska få bli. Vilket också gör det möjligt för oss att ha en oberoende och fri röst och vi är extra stolta över detta stöd och uppbackning av Sveriges muslimer. Hjälp oss lansera säsong 3 med dunder och brak, inshallah. Stötta säsong 3 med ett frivilligt belopp via vårt Swish-nummer eller bankgironummer. Swish-numret och bankgironumret hittar du som vanligt på vår hemsida koranpodden.se. Må Allah belöna dig för att du hjälper oss fortsätta Koranpodden med säsong 3. Glöm inte att följa oss på Facebook och Instagram för inspirerande och upplyftande koransitat under vinterledigheten. Och vill du komma i kontakt med mig så gör du det lättast genom att maila mig på hej@koranpodden.se. Det återstår det bara för mig att önska dig en härlig vinterledighet. Glöm inte mig i din dua, i din åkallan. Tack för att du lyssnar på Koranpodden. Vi hörs igen måndagen den 3 februari 2020. Ta väl hand om dig och dina nära och kära tills dess och njut av vinterledigheten. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.